Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. We're going to spend some time now with Preet Bharara. He served as U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York for 7.5 years, until 2017, when President Trump fired him shortly after taking office. Bharara had expected to stay on. Here he is in November 2016 in the lobby of Trump Tower, talking about a meeting he just had with then-President-elect Trump.
We had a good meeting. I said I would absolutely consider staying on. I agreed to stay on. I have already spoken Senator Sessions, who is, as you know, the nominee to be the Attorney General. He also asked that I stay on, and so I expect that I'll be continuing the work at the Southern District of New York.
Bharara is out with a new book called Doing Justice, A Prosecutor's Thoughts on Crime, Punishment, and the Rule of Law. He'll be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight, but he joins us here first. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So you opened the book describing how you were writing it in the midst of what we'll call an involuntary career change. I think that's a nice way to put it.
Right.
And then you're telling the president called you in March of 2017. So this is just less than 3 months after he's taken office. And you didn't take the call. Why not? And do you regret that?
I don't regret it in the least. And in fact, it was less than 2 months after he took office. I didn't expect to be in the position of U.S. attorney after Donald Trump won the presidency. There's the natural tradition of the U.S. attorneys from the prior administration leaving in an orderly fashion so that there's continuity in the various offices that try to do justice in America. But he asked me to stay, and of his own accord. I met with him in Trump Tower. The clip you played was me coming down from the meeting, and Donald Trump shook my hand and said, yeah, I want you to stay. He's his prerogative to change his mind anytime he wants. It's his authority, and I don't have any dispute with that. The odd thing was, he began to call me, personally, not going through the Justice Department or any other transition officials when he was the president-elect, which is a little odd. You know, normally, sitting U.S. attorneys do not have a personal relationship and don't start to develop a personal relationship with someone who's going to take over the White House. But he was not yet the president, and I told folks about it, and we thought it was okay to take those calls. Then he became the president and called me on, I think, March 9th of 2017, and left a message because I had been away from my desk and my assistant had left early. And then that was an unusual circumstance, that you have a president who has, you know, various interests in the jurisdiction of the Southern District of New York, as people now very clearly know, given what my old office is doing with respect to Michael Cohen. And it's a real question of whether or not you subject yourself to an unmonitored conversation that bypasses all the protocols and doesn't have the attorney general on, not knowing what the nature of the conversation was going to be. And, you know, I didn't necessarily think he was going to ask me to do something untoward, but it seemed weird and odd to have a side conversation in that fashion, especially after Donald Trump himself had made such a big deal of the fact that then Attorney General Loretta Lynch met with Bill Clinton during the time that his wife, Hillary Clinton, was being investigated. And Donald Trump himself went to rally after rally saying, well, what do you think happened in that conversation? And I didn't want to put myself in a position that would be compromised and also, quite frankly, for the protection of the president himself. So 22 hours later, I was asked to resign. I can't prove that those two acts were related to each other, but I'd find it hard to believe that they weren't. And now, given what I know and the world knows about what Donald Trump thinks about the wall between politics and law enforcement, on the one hand telling Jim Comey, can you lay off Michael Flynn, if you believe Jim Comey, and I do. On the other hand, saying, can you do something with the Justice Department for Joe Arpaio, that he has a penchant for trying to interfere in law enforcement, particularly when it might suit his interests. And so I don't have any regrets at all about not calling the president back.
So you were thinking about proprietary optics and ultimately the rule of law. Do you believe that the current administration with the Justice Department now under William Barr shares those types of proprietary concerns?
I think most of them probably do. I think the line prosecutors in the 93 U.S. attorney's offices around the country, I think the people in my old office, I think they're great, upstanding men and women in the FBI, at Maine Justice. I think Bill Barr is a professional. I think he has a tough task in dealing with a mercurial president who hates the fact that anybody dares to investigate anything that comes into contact with him, whether it's his business or his foundation or people who he's employed. And he, you know, with a broad brush, paints everything as a witch hunt in the same way that he paints everything he doesn't like in the media as fake news. So I think it I think there are a lot of people who are doing things the right way, but I think there's a lot of pressure from the White House to do otherwise.
Right. He's used that term witch hunt to describe the investigation being led by Robert Mueller. And we don't know when that's going to come, but it could come any day from what we understand. And the president did say just yesterday that he actually thinks the report should be made public.
Let it come out. Let people see it. That's up to the attorney general. We have a very good attorney general. He's a very highly respected man. And we'll see what happens. But it's sort of interesting that a man out of the blue just writes a report.
Just out of the blue.
Just out of the blue.
Some former FBI director. Right. But in all seriousness, he is trying to use that kind of terminology, I think, to degrade public confidence in not only Mueller, but we've also seen him do it with sort of law enforcement in general. So what's your concern level about
that? He does it with everything and everyone that he doesn't agree with. He can't even be consistent on about Fox News that is, you know, a lot of people think is basically state television. There are one or two anchors there who every once in a while deign to say something negative about Donald Trump, and he singles them out and says, well, they don't belong there. You know, one of the things I write about in the book is that if you're a prosecutor or an investigator, it is part of the job to take criticism from the people that you're investigating. Witch hunt is not a new epithet, a new description of things going on. And I describe how, you know, I was criticized. My office has been criticized sometimes for being too tough in the view of some people, sometimes for being too soft. But it's par for the course. You learn to take it. The difference is that when the potential subject or target is not some, you know, regular-sized billionaire or politician or state official, but the president of the United States, he has the biggest microphone on the planet. And when he decides to use his office and his pulpit to denigrate falsely in many ways someone who served his country honorably like Bob Mueller, that has a very, very insidious effect on the system. It has an insidious effect on people's faith in the system, and I think it's something we should be worried about.
So the Mueller report is probably the one that we're all waiting with the greatest bated breath for. Yeah. But as you mentioned earlier, your former office is also conducting its own investigatory work, largely around Michael Cohen, the president's former personal attorney, and that partly centers on president's payments to women who alleged to have had affairs with him more than a decade ago, Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal. And we've heard others, including Alan Dershowitz, say that it's actually investigations in the Southern District of New York that should most alarm the president, even more so than the Mueller report. Do you agree?
I do, based on what I know from publicly available information. That's for a few reasons. One, they are not limited in scope as to what they can look at. Unlike the Mueller team, the special counsel's office is very circumscribed in what they're allowed to look at based on the mandate under which he was appointed. Second, I think the nature of the folks at the Southern District who are apolitical, who follow the law and the facts wherever they lead. I tell a lot of stories in the book about, you know, the culture and the philosophy and the DNA and the character of the people in the Southern District. And so if people are wondering what that place is like, you'll learn a lot about it in the pages of the book, which I dedicate to my family first and then second to the men and women of the Southern District of New York. They also have an independent streak. And I mean that in an appropriate way, that they are not swayed by public opinion in one direction or the other. They're not afraid of people who are in power. And so I think they'll do what's right. And they're very smart, hardworking, and dedicated to the rule of law.
Well, that was certainly the takeaway I got from your book, and I wonder if you could just explain that a little bit more, because you're raising some acute concerns now. But I read your book and came away with the sense that you have an overall optimistic take on our justice system, even as you point out some flaws. So why do you remain optimistic?
Yeah, I do. I mean, there's lots of different things that need fixing in the justice system. I think criminal justice reform can go a lot further than it has gone. And I think that a lot of people sort of at the line level, you know, the everyday folks who you don't see on television and whose names you may not know, many of whom have great stories that I tell in the book, I think they're in a great place. But you know what? Leadership matters too. And what the president says about the leadership matters also. And you have this drumbeat every day from the president denigrating not just particular people in the FBI who are gone, but in large measure, the FBI generally, the intelligence community generally, and taking the word of strongmen like Vladimir Putin and others over the word of his own intelligence community, law enforcement community, I think that has, you know, I think that has a very detrimental effect on those agencies, and also on people's perception of those agencies. You know, every day, FBI agents and law enforcement officials go into court and they raise their right hand and they testify about the facts of a case. And you have a president who's undermining their credibility generally. I understand that people might say, well, he's singling people out. He doesn't really do that in the same way that he conflates legal immigration and illegal immigration, when push comes to shove, his supporters will say, well, no, he's talking about a couple of bad apples, or he's talking about illegal immigration. But if you follow the rhetoric overall and the dog whistles that are issued, he's painting a broad brush over and over and over again, and that's not good for the justice system.
So you write about a long career in which you take on the likes of Al-Qaeda, the mafia, Wall Street. But as you well know, some Americans do question whether you were tough enough on that last group, on Wall Street, after the financial crisis of the last decade, and they wonder why so few bankers were convicted of crimes. So what do you say to those people?
Yeah, I say they're right to be frustrated. And I spend time in the book talking about one of the most difficult things a prosecutor has to learn to do is to walk away when you believe that there has been misconduct and people have been hurt. If the law doesn't allow you to bring the case, if the standard is such that you can't meet it and the facts aren't there, you don't have a cooperating witness or you don't have a wiretap, then the just thing to do, even if it's frustrating, in our system is you don't bring the criminal case. Maybe there are other punishments. Maybe there can be a civil case, although I will note that there was no even regulatory matter by any agency against the head of a financial institution in the wake of the financial crisis, even though regulatory agencies have a much lower burden of proof. And the people who got assigned cases that might have led to some prosecution at the highest level in connection with the financial crisis, and there are many offices, not just mine, in D.C., in California, in New Jersey, in Chicago, in many other places. And out of hundreds and hundreds of career folks, I'm not aware of anyone suggesting or recommending to a U.S. attorney or to the attorney general that there was a makeable case. And that is extraordinarily frustrating because there was a lot of harm. But a lot of people worked really hard and put in a lot of resources but did not find a case to make. And I get that. But, you know, sometimes the case can't be made. Sometimes people engaged in conduct that allowed them, the ability to avoid prosecution. And sometimes the conduct was reckless, greedy, venal, negligent, but didn't cause someone to say there was a provable crime.
I do want to ask you about one other point of criticism that you address in the book. You describe the, quote, avalanche of vitriol and bile that came with your prosecution of an Indian diplomat in 2013. I'm sure you remember this episode very well.
Thanks for reminding me.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping you can remind us a little bit more. Would you read a little bit of what you wrote about that episode on page 207 of your book?
You got very far in the book. I appreciate that. This is when we prosecuted an Indian diplomat, not for the crime of the century, but for visa fraud and failing to pay a domestic worker, I think, more than $1 a day. So as I write on page 207, talk show hosts in India took to calling me a self-loathing Indian who made it a point to go after people from the country of his birth. My colleagues and I found it all a bit odd because the alleged victim in the case was also Indian. An Indian official asked on television, "Who the hell is Preet Bharara?" I was identified on another program as the most hated man in that country. The criticism grew more and more intense, which might not have bothered me so much had my parents not been reading every word of it. It upset them greatly. Then came the evening when my daughter overheard a conversation in the living room. She asked me, "Daddy, what is an Uncle Tom?" Because that's what I was being called by journalists in South Asia. That was not pleasant. It certainly wasn't.
So how on earth did you answer the question? What did you tell her?
You know, I explained to her the origin of it. I don't remember the exact words I used, but, you know, people who are listening know what that means. And part of the point I make in the book is, look, everyone is subject to criticism. And to grow as a person, you need to be able to distinguish between criticism that's meritorious and take that as feedback and improve yourself, but then criticism that's ludicrous and stupid, like that was. And those allegations were, you have to take a little bit with a grain of salt. I go on, I won't read the whole thing, but I go on to say that the moment when I really thought it was getting overly ludicrous and my attitude changed a little bit and I got a better sense of perspective on it was at some point somebody in the Indian press said that, you know, they knew that I was, my office was prosecuting these people and this diplomat for the following reason, that I'd undertaken the case for only one reason, to serve my quote unquote white masters. My white masters, presumably Eric Holder and Barack Obama. So you realize
the irony
of that, yes.
A former president there, Eric Holder, a gentleman who's mulled a run for president. Last question to you, Preet Bharara. Are you thinking about higher office yourself?
Well, I was born in India, so no presidency for
no
me.
Presidency,
I'm not going to be one of the 3,500 people who are running. You know, I like public service. I enjoyed my time in public service. I did it for 17 years. If there's another way I can serve, I would look forward to it. Politics is not my cup of tea, so I don't see that happening anytime soon.
All right. Preet Bharara served as the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York from 2009 to 2017. He'll be at a Harvard Bookstore event tonight, and there's more information about it and the book at our website, radioboston.org. Preet Bharara, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. Thanks so much.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.